Okay, we're going to begin today with an exercise to see if you all can recognize some of these common everyday sayings. And here we go. The first one, there is no gain without pain. That's right. God helps those who help. You are good. No such thing as a free lunch. That's right. Too good to be true. See, he got exactly what he deserves, and we reap what we sow. Okay, well, those must be pretty well known, mustn't they? You all did really well with that. And you know, while all of those might be true in the relative world, some of us might be left just wondering about that, as in the Gospel according to Snoopy, we hear Lucy saying, sooner or later, Charlie Brown, there's one thing you're going to have to learn. You reap what you sow. You get out of life exactly what you put into it, no more and no less. So Snoopy ponders that for a while, and then he thinks to himself, I'd kind of like to see a little more margin for error. Well, here's the good news. Here is the good news. There is a margin for error, and that margin for error is really a safety net, and it is called grace. Unity author Eric Butterworth says that few words in all of Christianity are used more and understood less than the term the grace of God. He says it is really surrounded with an air of theological mystery, and yet the meaning of grace is actually very simple. It means favor. Now, I don't know about you and your siblings, but my brother and I argue constantly, still today, about which one of us was the favored child. And actually, he was favored by my mother, but I think I was favored by my father, so it worked out. But the point is, our divine creator has no favorites, no favorites. Every single one of us is a beloved child of the Most High. Spirit's love for us is pure and unconditional. And the grace of God is actually God's love in action in our lives. So while at some level we do reap what we sow, especially in our own consciousness, God's omnipresent love is so pure, so intense, that through grace we never completely reap what we sow. I'm sorry, we never completely reap the harvest of error. And we always reap more than we sow. I'm going to say that again. We never fully reap the harvest of our mistakes, and we always reap more than we sow. Now, that's good news for Snoopy, and that's good news for all of us, right? It really is. And what's so amazing about grace? We have that term, amazing grace. What's so amazing about it? Well, unlike lunch, grace is always free. We do nothing to earn it. We can't buy it, borrow it, bargain for it, or steal it. All we have to do is open our minds and hearts to accept it. And God's love and mercy are always available, whether or not we feel we deserve it. Grace is our anchor in the storm. It's our harbor when outer conditions seem threatening. It's our sanctuary of peace and joy. For in the harbor of grace, we always receive above and beyond what we ask for, what we seek, even what we dream for. And as we've said, the grace of God is impartial. It's no respecter of individuals. It's equally available to all of us, male, female, black, white, Asian, Christian, Jew, Muslim, American or Iranian, rich or poor, gay or straight. This unequivocal, unconditional love and goodness of God are actually sometimes beyond our human comprehension. It's hard for us to wrap our heads around it. And instead of understanding that we are created in God's image and likeness, sometimes we turn it around and we think that God is created in ours. And Anne Lamott reminds us in one of my favorite quotes, you can safely assume that you've created God in your image when it turns out that God hates all the people you hate. That rings true, doesn't it? And obviously, we know in our hearts, God cannot hate. God is only love. And all of creation is equally loved by the divine. And those things that we call miracles are really manifestations of God's grace on this earth. An instant healing, walking away from a horrible accident without a scratch, the birth of a child to a woman who's been told she could never conceive. But also God's grace manifests for us in those everyday things that we tend to take for granted. A beautiful sunset, a newborn puppy, the blessing of waking up in the morning, and every breath we draw. Grace is everywhere. We're swimming in it. And yet, sometimes we're not attuned to it. What we really need to do is just open our spiritual eyes and see the goodness all around us. I will never forget, it's been years ago, but I'll never forget the morning that I got my first pair of contact lenses. I drove home and passed by this park that I had seen countless times before, noticing for the very first time in a long time the bright green of the trees and bushes, the vivid colors of the flowers along the road, the intricate pattern of the sunlight filtering through the trees. All those things had been blurry and suddenly became crystal clear. And that's, I think, what Marcel Proust was talking about when he said, "The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes." And grace works exactly the same way. We begin to see it when it's always been there. Now, sometimes those moments of grace actually come in a flash. And like Paul's conversion at Damascus, we can be blinded by the light. That's what happened to John Newton, who wrote the song, at least he wrote the lyrics for the song, Amazing Grace. Now, how many of you know John Newton's story? A lot of you know it. It's a really interesting story. Like many of us, his life path was formed by a variety of twists and circumstances. His mother died of tuberculosis when he was 6 years old, and by the time he was 11, he went to sea with his father, who was a commander of a merchant ship in the Mediterranean. So not much of a childhood. After his father's death, Newton served in the Royal Navy, but found conditions so deplorable in the ship that he actually deserted, and he was eventually captured and publicly flogged. He then became a servant of a slave trader, and there he was brutally abused. Finally, in the late 1700s, he ended up himself the captain of a slave ship. And one night during that time in his life, a violent storm struck. As the ship lurched and rocked, the crew struggled for hours in the raging storm, emptying water and expecting at any moment to be capsized. Finally, Newton and another mate tied themselves to the ship's pump to keep from being washed overboard. And in that moment, Newton, who couldn't swim, recalled a Bible verse that his mother had read to him years ago about God's mercy. And he cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us." Years later, he would write that his next thought at that moment had been, "How could the Lord possibly have mercy on a wretch like me?" And in that moment, when he was clinging to that ship, he was filled with an overpowering sense of love and peace greater than anything he had ever known. And by the time that battered ship and the starving crew landed in Ireland a couple weeks later, John Newton emerged with a new vision. He believed that God had sent him a profound message the night of the storm, and he went on to become an Anglican priest who spent the rest of his life working for the abolition of slavery. And those lyrics from Amazing Grace were a reflection of that moment in time in the middle of that terrifying storm when he experienced the grace of God. Now, our realization of God's grace might not be quite that dramatic, hopefully it isn't, but I know that all of us can think of times in our lives when we found great strength and peace in the midst of a stormy life challenge, and yet we emerged with it with new insight and vision and a clear realization of God's amazing grace and unconditional love. There's a Bible story that I think illustrates how grace works in our lives, and it's found in John 8, 1 through 11. I'm going to read just the beginning of it to start with. Then each of them went home, while Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came to the temple. All the people came to him and sat down, and he began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law of Moses, we are commanded to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They said this to test him so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Now, to understand what this story is all about, it's important to remember that the Hebrew Bible taught God is law. The Mosaic covenant was, obey God and you shall be rewarded, disobey God and you will be punished. And spelled out in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, the law required that anyone engaging in adultery be executed. Actually, it required anyone, the man and the woman. But the man is missing from this story. So, anyway, I'll leave you to make your own conclusions there. But the law was that anybody would be executed. And in terms of the caught in the act part, Jewish law declared that compromising circumstances were not sufficient evidence. There had to be actual eyewitnesses. So the Pharisees and company drag this poor woman out, making a spectacle of her, publicly accusing her of adultery, and professing to have eyewitnesses. I'm going to let that part go at the moment and go on with the story in a minute. Actually, this is also really what we might call a sting operation to trap Jesus. You see, the Romans did not allow the Jews to carry out death sentences. And so if Jesus said to stone the woman, he would have been going against Roman law. If he said not to stone her, however, he would have been going against Jewish law, as we just read. And so at this point, it looks like they've trapped Jesus masterfully. But let's continue. Verse 7. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin cast the first stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. And when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said to her, "Then neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." So Jesus' answer to the Pharisees completely disarms them. Once he speaks of throwing the stone, since he speaks of throwing the stone, they cannot accuse him of violating Jewish law. And since he does not condemn the woman to execution, they cannot condemn him of breaking the Roman law. And Charles Fillmore tells us, I'm having microphone troubles today, sorry. Charles Fillmore tells us that metaphysically, the Pharisees represent thoughts that bind us to external rules, rituals, and laws of religion. The Pharisees obey the laws of the Old Testament to the letter. And of course, they added a few of their own, 600 to be exact, 600 man-made rules to earn God's favor. And just think of it. I love this picture of them. No love, no joy, no compassion for others. Theirs was a strict, somber religion, reminding us of Mark Twain's quip, "Having spent considerable time with good Christian people, I can understand why Jesus liked to be with tax collectors and sinners." I'm sure a lot of people in the day felt that way about the Pharisees. And Jesus uses their little scheme to trap them, to demonstrate a principle greater than all their rules and regulations put together, the principle of pure divine energy that does not condemn, but only loves. And what in the world is all this writing on the ground stuff about? Well, we know that Jesus didn't travel with a laptop in those days, so what message was he writing? Bible scholars and religious leaders have debated this for centuries. Some say Jesus was just doodling, vying for time. Others say it was an outer act designed to show his intentional disregard for the Pharisees. Still others believe that Jesus wrote the names and the sins, the life errors, in other words, of the men, perhaps in the order of oldest to youngest, because that's the order in which they left, saying to them, in effect, don't judge, lest you be judged. Perhaps fulfilling a prophecy in the Old Testament in Jeremiah that said, they that depart from me shall be written on the earth. And in that case, the educated Pharisees, because they were the ones with the education in those days, they would have made the connection and realized that Jesus was implying that they had departed from the true intent of God. Well, whatever it was that Jesus wrote, and we will never know now, it works. No one in the crowd picks up a stone. Instead, one by one, the Pharisees walk away, leaving Jesus alone with the woman. And despite the fact that it seemed clear that the woman had been guilty, despite the fact that she never even proclaimed her innocence, despite the fact that there were eyewitnesses, Jesus says to her what has been called one of the most important utterances of spiritual awareness throughout literature. He says to her, "Neither do I condemn you." Jesus is operating here from a greater perspective than law. He is operating from the unconditional love of God, to whom there is nothing to forgive. Jesus is in the realm, and he is showing the woman divine grace. Now notice, the text doesn't ever say if she was found innocent or guilty or pardoned or not. It simply tells us that she was not condemned. And Jesus tells her, go and sin no more. In other words, go and release error thinking and error behavior and be the best Christ you can be. I have the feeling here that the woman received the gift of grace, that she at that point was open to it, and that her life was transformed by that interaction. Her encounter with Jesus represents the overpowering power of the Christ mind doing its work in our minds to erase all error and unholy thinking. And by unholy thinking, I mean thinking that we are anything less than whole. So the Pharisees drop their stones and walk away from Jesus. And you know, our co-founder Charles Fillmore tells us that we are to look at every Bible character and see ourselves in the Bible characters. Well, I don't know about you, but I'd rather see myself in Jesus than in the Pharisees. How do you all feel about that? However, honestly, sometimes we are like the Pharisees. Sometimes we turn away from the Christ of our being to outer appearances, worry, negative thinking, and judgments. And for a myriad of reasons, sometimes we refuse to accept that beautiful gift of God's grace. Perhaps we don't believe in it and trust it. Perhaps we've taken into our consciousness that common belief that it's too good to be true. That's right. Maybe we're stuck in our consciousness in that endless cycle of the old idea of the law of karma, thinking that every single error we make comes back to haunt and punish us. And maybe, worst of all, we don't think we're worthy of God's pure, unequivocal love. If we hold any of those attitudes, grace is our opportunity to change our minds. God's grace offers us redemption from our unholy thinking, our thinking that we are anything less than whole. That's the redemption piece of this story. And this story also reminds us that Jesus is right there, ready to teach the Pharisees a new way of being, just as the Christ's presence is always with us and within us waiting for expression. The story highlights the new law that Jesus came to teach, and that was love one another as yourself, and love one another as I have loved you. Absolutely. A genuine understanding of love holds no room for judgment. A legalistic view of God only makes enemies. Understanding that everything comes from God and through God makes us appreciate one another. My father's favorite expressions, I can just hear this again and again in my childhood. One of his favorite expressions was, "Don't judge your neighbor until you walk two moons in his moccasins." And, you know, when Jesus says to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin throw the first stone," he forces them to walk for a moment in her moccasins, realizing that they too had made mistakes. Maybe not her mistake, but other mistakes. They'd done things they regretted. They had disappointed their loved ones, and maybe they had disappointed themselves. Empathy kills condemnation. Empathy fosters love. And empathy helps all of us behold the Christ in one another. So through the grace of Christ, by the grace of God, I am what I am, it says in 1 Corinthians. And through that, all of us are called to be God's expression on this earth. Wholeness, peace, harmony, faith, strength, and wisdom. This innate God-given intention is what made the prodigal son, after much self-imposed suffering, you know that sin is self-inflicted nonsense, right? It made the prodigal son come to himself, as the text says. And he actually says, "I will arise and go to my father," expecting at that point only to serve as one of his father's hired hands. Remember the story? And the father's reaction in the story, as he looks for his son and sees him in the distance, the father's reaction has been called one of the clearest and deepest descriptions of what Jesus taught about our oneness with God, because the Father obviously represents God in the story. And remember, the Father sees his Son and runs to meet him, filled with joy at his Son's return. The Son goes into his planned little speech of penance, you know, "I have sinned and I am no longer worthy to be called your Son." But the Father doesn't even listen. What does he do? No punishment, only joy and celebration and abundance. Abundance that flows far beyond the son's expectations. Remember, he calls for the best robe, which is a symbol of honor and status. He puts a ring on his son's finger, a symbol of authority, and he puts sandals on his son's feet. Hired hands would have been barefoot. And all of these symbolize the father is restoring the son to his rightful place, bringing him back into the house of God where there is only love and grace. What a beautiful example this story is of the grace of God, showing us that we can never be too lost, too mired in negative thinking and harmful actions, to know the love and grace of God. And when we accept this magnificent grace, we are like John Newton, transformed. We live in constant awareness of God's magnificent presence within us. We live as the love, wisdom, and harmony of God. We live and move and have our being in God's amazing grace. And so it is. And so let's just take a moment now as we prepare for prayer and meditation to just affirm the great truth about our Heavenly Father Mother. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.